Philip?
I want to address three different issues here. First, following quite a few of the comments that have been made already, why I think the time is in fact ripe for this, and I think some of this will also go into the issue of these new security challenges. The second, I'll go way out on a limb and try to project in fact to that 25 or further time frame and say what I believe some of the fundamental challenges and discontinuities are. And the gist of my thing will be the nation state is not really the central focus. The discontinuity, actually, we've just been through, which was the emphasis on the nation state. And then finally, speaking for my discipline, I want to just say a little bit about what you might expect from political science, in particular what professional political science looks like, as opposed to how you see it on the popular media or even as undergraduates. So let me start with this comment on why the time is right. It's been pointed out by a number of people. We're all aware of the fact there was this rather unfortunate alienation between the academy, particularly the social sciences and the humanities, and the military for a period of about 30 years after Vietnam. And the point that I think we need to remember is that was an unusual, that if you go before that, you see a completely different picture, and this has been alluded to earlier. And I think part of that, just two points on that. One is simply the realization, particularly both with the U.S. Entry into a global role in the late 1930s, and certainly in the Cold War, that there were major problems that were really serious that we couldn't, find simple solutions, that there probably were not simple solutions to, like a bipolar system with nuclear weapons, like decolonization, that you really needed to devote a lot of effort to. I'm editing a special issue of a journal on content analysis, and as part of the editor's introduction, went back and looked at the history of that. It's a technical method for analyzing public communication. And what you see in the content analysis, which was developed for policy purposes, is not just academic involvement, but really a who's who at the absolute top of the field in both political science and psychology in that field. So it wasn't just the people were involved, it was that the top people were involved. We obviously went through some unpleasantness on both sides, really, in Vietnam, but I think that has very much broken down. I wouldn't say we're completely past that, but I think from the academic side, there are reasons to think that, to see that now we are, again, in a period where we need to take some serious look at this. I think this actually started about 10 years ago with the recognition that there had been a failure of international response to both Yugoslavia and Rwanda, and of course, we're seeing this again in Darfur, that simply with the end of the Cold War, simply saying, singing give peace a chance isn't going to be enough. While we're singing give peace a chance, some other people are doing ethnic cleansing. 9/11, of course, was a very serious wake-up call that there are people out there that are interested in killing us and lots of other people. And I think the other thing that has happened, and I think this may be part of the reason the military is interested, is that whether or not you agree about the decision to invade Iraq, it did not go as planned. There was a very serious failure there at some point. Now, it may have been people weren't listening to the right people or whatever. But, Iraq was not supposed to be, was not supposed to evolve the way that it did. And I think there's a recognition that we need some more help. So I think I would also, follow that. Yeah, I think Minerva has gotten it, particularly with respect to the open source and non-classified, non-restricted research. And I think there, well, obviously, we've already seen a big response. So what are some of those challenges? Well, I've listed three already. Let me go way out on a limb and say that I think the single biggest challenge is that we're going to move away from a system that is focused primarily on the nation state. If you've taken Introduction to International Relations, and probably most people in this room did at one point, we have a standard line on the nation state. We're following Hans Morgenthau's original version, which is we go back and we look at Thucydides' Peloponnesian Wars and say, oh, Greek city-state system, it looks like nation states. In fact, even bipolar system. Oh, cool. And then we cough a couple of times and look at our watches and say, now Machiavelli, Italian city-state system, that looks like a nation-state system. And then we go on to the rise of European absolutism and Metternich and Bismarck, et cetera, et cetera. And we say it's all nation states, you know, turtles all the way down. Well, the problem is that between Thucydides and Machiavelli, there was 1800 years, which is a long time. That's about half of recorded human history. And during that 1800 years, it wasn't a nation state system. In fact, there was barely any time, at least in the West, that you had anything remotely resembling a system of equal sovereign independent states. About half of that was characterized by the largely hierarchical system of the Roman First Republic and then the Roman Empire, and then the second half, this very complex system that we call the Middle Ages or the medieval period. But the point is, it wasn't a nation-state system. And this is important because what we basically looked at is a very, very tiny part of human history, and then the last, it's not really 350, we pretend it's 350 years since 1648, but I've got a nice obnoxious set of PowerPoint slides arguing that the dominant of the nation state in the international system basically encompasses the career of Elvis Presley plus 10 years. So it's really only about 25 years. And this leads us to being surprised by things that we shouldn't be surprised about. So let's just take Al-Qaeda. What's Al-Qaeda? Okay, it's non-territorial, religiously motivated, ideologically and religiously motivated, transnational, and they run around killing innocent people in rather large numbers when they can get away with it. And we look at that and we say, oh, Al-Qaeda, you know, you're breaking the rules. You know, this isn't fair. You know, you shouldn't be doing this kind of thing. And yet I would suggest that if you look at the 1,000 years, which again, pretty long time, between 650 and 1650, if you were going to get killed by somebody living more than 50 miles away, and you know, that's not how most people get killed. Ask any cop, you're most likely to get killed by your spouse or your neighbor or your business partner, particularly in certain businesses. But you know, if you're going to get killed by a stranger, in all likelihood, that was probably going to be by a militarized, religiously motivated non-state actor, whether it's in the crusade, the Christian Muslim crusades, whether it was in the internal Christian crusades, such as the Albigensian crusade, whether it's in the Wars of Reformation, et cetera, or similar wars, well, less so in the Islamic world. So the point is, Al-Qaeda was not the exception. Al-Qaeda is, in some ways, the rule. Now, it's not just Al-Qaeda. It's not just religiously motivated groups, nor are all these groups necessarily hostile. We talk about NGOs. If you look at the most powerful and successful and, in a lot of ways, permanent entities within the medieval period, they are fairly similar to what we would call NGOs. They're typically monasteries. But and this is stuff we've seen before, and they were providing a lot of the same services that NGOs provide today. We've seen this sort of stuff in the past. So my argument here, there's a wonderful quote from Churchill, who was himself a very, very accomplished popular historian, that the further that you look back, the clearer you can see forward. And I think that as we look forward to 2025, 2050, and so forth, looking back and not just looking at trying to redo World War I and figure out where the Kaiser went wrong, we're going to be better off looking at these sorts of things. And that does, in fact, mean looking at Thucydides, looking at Machiavelli, looking at people that we don't look at that much, for example, Cicero, to get guidance on a world that's dominated by a single large power, or Ibn Khaldun, who's the preeminent classical theorist on tribalism. And you're hearing this from a quantitative guy. You're hearing this from a guy who makes his money crunching numbers, but I really do believe this. So finally, a couple of words on what to expect from political science. The first thing, I think there's a little bit of confusion about what a professional political scientist does. First, the thing that we clearly don't do is what the bloviators on Fox and CNN do. You know, they're just there to provide entertainment so you won't turn the channel between watching the beer commercials. And I think the fact that the single most widely used and trusted news source in America today is The Daily Show tells you something about the role of politics in commercial entertainment. The other thing, and we're sort of at fault in doing this, it's generally not what you, again, I'm sure there were a lot of people here who are political science undergraduates. It's not generally what we teach undergraduates. Unfortunately, we have mortgages to pay and families to feed, and the parents of people who would like to think that they want to go to law school are pretty good at providing us employment. So we tend, I wouldn't say we dumb it down, but we orient more towards that popular orientation. When you move into the graduate level, you see a very different different field. And it's the American Political Science Association meetings start tomorrow. And the Wall Street Journal typically goes to the APSA and they write an article that's basically political scientists are morons. And what they're upset about is they can't read the papers and they can't read the American Political Science Review. Like, there's a problem with this, okay? You know, if they went to a conference on cosmological string theory, you think they'd be able to read the papers? The point is that at that professional level, we are dealing with a much greater amount of theory, a much more technique, and I think in here we're somewhat different than anthropology and data. And in particular, I'd emphasize theory. It's the theory that is the multiplier. It's the theory that tells you what to look for. But in addition, we've got very sophisticated techniques, both quantitative, the sort of stuff I do, but also increasingly in the qualitative area. And we've got data. We've got a lot of data. You know, the world is drowning in data, and we're doing a pretty good job of starting to figure out how to use this, what to pay attention to, and so forth. So just going back momentarily to the classics, to try to give you a sense of where we are, let's look at the development of, you know, why Aristotle, who quite arguably was the first political scientist, why he was doing what he was doing. He was arguing against Plato. Plato was arguing against the sophists. The sophists were basically saying politics is whatever you can get away with, whatever you can persuade people to do. That's Karl Rove, that's Mark Penn, that's that crew. Plato goes and says, well, you know, politics is this wonderful ideal, so I'm going to design the perfect state, and it's going to have philosopher kings, and they're not going to have families, and they're not going to have property, and all that kind of stuff. And Aristotle, who must have been a bit of a pain to have in class, but Aristotle says to Plato, that's nuts, okay? You can't show me any cases where that works. What I'm going to do, I, Aristotle, is I'm going to go out and look at the real world. I'm going to look at the way that the various Greek city-states are constituted. That is what politics is about. And that is, if a professional political scientist is doing their job, they're going to go in and look at those that, you know, 3,500 years of human history, they're going to apply systematic technique to that, and they're going to collect systematic data. And that, I think, will be relevant, just as it was in the 1940s and 1950s, to the challenges that we face in the next 25 and 50 years.
Good. Well, Philip, thanks for offering up a vision of the world, one not dominated by nation states, and starting to hint at some of the theory and the method that may, and the disciplines that may give us some traction on understanding that world.